Nation. You are once again listening and seeing the Career Pathways podcast, brought to you from Lyon College in the Kilt Studio, deep in the basement of the Mabee Simpson Library. Joining me is producer Cheyenne. Say hello.
Hello, hello.
Yes, she's there making the magic happen behind the scenes, but always prominent. That's what we say. Also joining me, special guest, our two-timer, Dr. Paul Beube. How are you, sir?
Doing all right, thanks. Yep.
We got a special podcast today because we wanted to talk about two things. One is being a professor of religion. You and I've had very good conversations about where is Christianity today? We'll get into it right now, but we'll explore it. And then the other thing is you're retiring at the end of this semester, and love to get kind of your thoughts, reflections on, you know, an academic year or academic career well spent. I mean, it's I'm sure, you know, there's going to be all kinds of things to think and talk about.
Sure.
All right. Christianity. Okay. I'll kind of throw it out there that, you know, there's Christianity, you know, it's been, you know, if I say it's politicized, it's like, well, gosh, it's been politicized probably forever. You know, it's been used for rationale for many things. But modern day, like the time we're in now, it's kind of, why is it that when I hear Christianity, all I can think of is conservative evangelicals? You know, I mean, what exactly has happened to Christianity as you see it?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things going on there. I'm going to give you a historical context here.
Yeah, please.
I'm going way back in history. I think if there was a time that Christianity wasn't politicized, it was before Constantine. When Constantine recognized Christianity as legitimate, you know, all the persecutions stop. He decided to use Christianity to unite his empire, which had been in fragment for many, for probably a century. And he was very successful to do it. He's the one who called the Council of Nicaea, which is the most important council in the history of Christianity. That's where the Nicene Creed is written, and where you settle the issue of the relationship of Jesus to God as fully human and fully divine. So that's a huge turning point in the history of Christianity. But Constantine, you know, has what you see is the church practices, especially worship services, start to reflect the Roman practices. You start using terms like priest and pontiff and other things. I mean, he was the supreme pontiff. And all of that, I mean, I've had Christian church history, you know, a lot of times. And, you know, when I started teaching this, I started seeing it in a different light and recognized that this was kind of a downfall in some ways for Christianity, because now it's not persecuted. Now people are joining it because there's something in it for them. And so,
what's in it for them?
Well, reward. I mean, think about it. You only have to do something for maybe, you know, 70, 80 years, and you get an infinite reward for that.
It was buying, like buying your ticket to heaven, which kind of was a practice. And
well, it certainly
became, like a more blatant practice, but it's still done. All right.
So, you know, I think when Christianity became a fad, now it's obviously gone up and down in different countries. It had different experiences. But as a general, a very vast generalization, you see that Christianity becomes more and more about people seeking something for themselves. So you don't become a Christian because you recognize, you know, who Jesus is and his relationship to God, and you want to be a part of that. you become a Christian because it might get you promoted.
Right.
It might get you around the right people, get you honors, bishops in the church. Many bishops over many centuries were often bringing in a lot of money and wealth to themselves. I mean, you have, again, within the church, strong efforts to keep that from happening or to stop it. But by and large, especially Western Christianity, right. Has moved in that direction. Now we fast forward to the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
and you start seeing, well, actually, I can go back since we're talking about the U.S. If you go back to the beginning of the U.S., mm-hmm. You have a German sociologist by the name of Max Weber,
mm-hmm.
who comes to America, and he's just fascinated by it. And he recognizes that there's
Protestant this, work ethic,
the Protestant work ethic, and what you see there is people worked hard to be Christian,
mm-hmm.
and worked hard in their jobs because that was their vocation. That's the Protestant side of it. A vocation wasn't becoming a priest or something like that, but the vocation was your job, and the harder you worked at that, and the more moral you are in mm-hmm. that, then the more you are assured that you have been predestined
right.
by God to salvation. Because this, the whole Protestant Reformation, in as it's carried out in the U.S., is really focused around a Calvinist understanding. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got Methodists out there that are Arminian, and they're not taking that
right.
the same way, but that notion that I know because I am good
right.
that I must be saved, then you're reassured. You're not earning it. You're mm-hmm. just reassuring yourself.
Right.
I mean, if you're scared that you're going to go to hell, you know, and you wonder if you're predestined to go to hell, well, this is a way to find out.
Yeah.
Then again, you know, what's in it for me?
Right.
I'm really doing this, you know, as a Christian in this time period to prove to myself that I'm saved.
Yeah.
And so that's something that has been within the Calvinist tradition for quite a while, even though I don't think Calvin quite moved out in that direction. But then you get into the 20th century. And in the 20th century, you have, and we go in cycles in the U.S.
Sure.
We've had these cycles of great awakenings, and then mm-hmm. just kind of we float for a while, and then we have right. another big awakening. And at the beginning of the century, in the 20th century, you have this Pentecostal outbreak,
mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, very charismatic in more ways than one,
right.
and brought in a lot of followers. It broke a lot of barriers,
right.
and in many ways, it was a very positive movement
mm-hmm.
within Christianity, especially in the U.S. And I would say even today, Pentecostal churches, by and large, tend to be more diverse mm-hmm. ethnically and otherwise than many Protestant churches are. But this, then you have this notion you got of what you feel,
right,
and Pentecostalism is really focused on feeling close to God,
mm-hmm.
Not knowing that you're close to God, but feeling it.
All right.
You know, and one Christian might say, well, I know that I'm close to God because I pray, I, you know, go to church, I study the Bible, but they're not necessarily excited, you know. Pentecostalism is very exciting. And you get a lot of positive feedback through these feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've ever been to a Pentecostal service, they're very, they're rowdy. I mean, people are singing out loud, they're prophesying, they're speaking in tongues.
Tongues, that's what I always associate. I was kind of reluctant to say that, but that's part of the service.
And speaking in tongues is generally an ecstatic experience.
Yeah, right.
It's a way of you immerse yourself into that sort of focus, that funnel of prayer. You don't know what you're saying, but you feel that it's a positive thing.
Is that the Holy Spirit?
Yes.
Okay.
That's the understanding. That's the Holy Spirit. Now, I was once in a Pentecostal Catholic group, which almost cost my faith.
Yeah.
And in that group, I mean, I joined that group. I was a freshman in college, and the Pentecostal movement in the Catholic Church started in South Bend, associated with Notre Dame. And I was scared. I was the first person in my family, you know, to go to college.
Yeah.
I never had lived away from home. I remember driving up to Notre Dame and
pretty intimidating.
I from the distance I could see the Golden Dome, and I told my dad to pull over because I had to throw up.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just that scared. And I had a roommate. I had two roommates. Mm-hmm. And one of my roommates had been involved in the charismatic movement, which is where Catholics typically talk about it, and back in Cleveland, where he had that experience, and he was interested in this, and he told me a lot about it, and I happened to have a professor who was a priest that was sort of the chaplain to the Pentecostal group on campus, so I had a lot of exposure to this. And I was, you know, I was looking for friends. I was looking for a place to belong.
Right.
My faith had always been an important part of me. I mean, I went to Catholic schools all the way through. And here I was in a Catholic university.
Yeah.
So I got involved with this group. I had a kind of conversion experience.
Mm-hmm.
I learned to speak in tongues.
Yeah.
I mean, I literally learned that they had to teach me how to speak in tongues.
Right.
I mean, once I got the hang of it, nothing would make any sense to anybody.
Sure.
I was in that. But I there was always kind of a distance. And the group that I was part of ended up being broken up because it was becoming cultish.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's typical of Pentecostal groups at all. Please don't get me wrong, but that group did become cultish.
Yeah.
In fact, the bishop intervened and told the person that was in charge of that group, who was abusing young men, that he needed to leave.
Yeah,
which is sadly, looking back, this was the typical Catholic response to abuse.
Yeah, move the problem to another parish.
But he was a lay person, though, and so there was not as much to do except turn him in, which is what they should have done. Yeah.
But he wasn't even a deacon. He was just a lay person.
A lay person. Yeah. That once all that happened, my faith just blew up.
Yeah.
I mean, it just totally blew up. Mm-hmm. And I became agnostic at that point in my life. I decided to major in theology because I wanted to figure out what was wrong with all this and try to get people straightened out.
Right.
I said, God, if you're there, if you can convince me in a year to, you know, come back to faith, I'll come back.
You gave God an ultimatum.
Yeah, more or less, yes.
Bravo.
And so you had, at Notre Dame, you had to take two theology classes and two philosophy classes. So I ended up being a double major in both. But I was in a class called Crisis of Belief.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the books we read was Albert Camus' The Plague.
Mm-hmm.
And now this is a guy who was agnostic. Some would say even atheistic. Some also claim that shortly before he died, he was taking lessons to become Catholic.
Yeah.
That's been debatable. But that book, which is about meaninglessness of life and how you create meaning and in the midst of all that, was what brought me back to God.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little bit ironic.
Yeah,
but it made me realize that there's something deep and all of this that seeks and discovers a truth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I probably took you way off where you wanted to go.
Please continue.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to give you my autobiography.
No. Well, this is a show about you, so yeah. It's wonderful that because you're kind of talking about the beginning of your career, and we're going to end it with kind of the closing.
Yeah.
Or at least this chapter of your career, where it goes. So then you know, how did we get to where we are right now?
Yeah.
How did we get to evangelical Christians supporting a twice divorced adulterer, felon,
rapist?
We'll call it a sexual abuser. That's the legal term, and somehow that is
overlooked.
Right. In an effort to quote save money, there's just kind of some inherent cruelty in what's being done to address DEI. There's like, it's not even inherent. It's just like a blatant racism that's starting to take hold, and somehow, yeah, there's not all Christians, but it's
a significant number.
Yeah. I'm trying to be understanding, but how is it that they could arrive at that and think that squares with their faith?
Yeah. I probably have a different theory about this month to month.
Yeah.
Yep. I ponder it a lot. And it bothers me because in my faith, my understanding of faith, and I've been very active in my faith for many years, humility is one of the most important of virtues that a Christian could have.
Right.
And that's the opposite of what we're seeing.
Right.
And it's the opposite of what's happened in many evangelical churches, not all, but many.
Yeah.
And I know some evangelicals that are just as dismayed as I am about, how Christianity seems to be going in America. But, you get the super church, these mega churches.
Yep.
And I visited one once. You walked in. It was the second largest church at the time in the country. And they had just finished building this new sanctuary.
Right.
And they were dedicating it. It was Christmas time. I had gone with a sister of mine who had joined this church.
Yeah.
And so we sat in seats that were as nice as a good theater seat.
Right.
The only thing they didn't have was cup holders.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling they've added them.
Why not?
Because they had a coffee shop.
Yeah.
When you walked in the door, it was almost like going into a mall.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bookstore that was selling souvenirs.
Yeah.
As well as books. There was a coffee shop. You walk in this auditorium that is just huge.
Yeah.
And so you got this, where we were in the cheap seats. We're looking down, and the guy looks like a miniature person down there. But above is this giant, jumbotron. It was a three panel so that it, covered the whole church. And the music was professional.
Yeah.
But it was, it seemed to me that the attraction of the church is that you get to be, rewarded now. Now they didn't, they weren't as extreme as some of these prosperity gospel people
are. A Joel Osteen or someone
But it's there. I mean,
So this was like a Rick Warren type of kind of.
Somewhat.
Yeah.
I'd gone to Rick Warren's church once.
At Saddleback, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was interesting. Yeah, it was. They were not as high tech.
Yeah.
The technology
got it. Yeah.
Made
yeah. Versus
of,
what you saw. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. so then going back, how, okay, here are all those people that are, you know, that are going to this mega church, and now, you know, from the, I guess in their case it's the stage, but the pulpit, you know,
it's a stage.
Yeah, the stage is they're now they're hearing a political message.
Yeah, I mean, just back up a tiny bit.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah.
You see a kind of race to be a mega church.
Right.
I mean, I think probably every young pastor wants to start a church,
yep,
or be a part of a church that is going to become a mega church. That's like, you know, the crown of,
right,
your career. These people become very prominent.
Mm-hmm.
The people who join these churches, you know, they're basking in, you know, the attention.
Right.
And people want to join because you want to be part of something like that.
Right.
It's all about being successful,
right,
in terms of numbers, in terms of the promise that, you know, you're going to be around people that are going to be making pretty good money.
Yeah.
And of course, the church is bringing in money hand over fist.
Right.
You know, I think that that temptation,
mm-hmm,
has pulled a lot of Christians in the direction of, we need to get a president that gets us.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you think about it, the parallel is amazing. You know, you have a president who claims, I mean, he was a millionaire when he started.
Sure.
But he claims, you know, he's a self-made man. That's right. How a lot of people live.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a billionaire.
Right.
And you know, people see that as, you know, he's achieved, you know, this is success.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a parallel to what you see in these mega churches.
Yeah.
They succeed.
Yeah.
Right? They bring in a lot of people. They got big audiences.
Right.
I don't think they're quite the same as a church audience, but
yeah,
they're not a congregation as much as they are an audience.
North Point Community Church, Andy Stanley, who's Charles Stanley's,
mm-hmm,
he recently passed, but Charles Stanley's son, and 7,000 per service, two services, you know, 14,000 yeah, every Sunday, just amazing. It was kind of a more of an energy and a noise to it, where Catholic service is so serene and quiet and chanting, mm-hmm, and kneeling and praying, and there's none of that. You know, you come in, it's almost you come to be entertained.
Yeah, and yeah. I've noticed that a lot of Catholics go to two services.
Yeah.
They go to the Catholic service,
and then
they go to the mega.
Yeah,
go to the non-denominational church.
Guilty as charged.
So,
right.
I mean, it's flashy.
Yeah.
It's exciting. The music is usually very good.
Yeah.
You know, you can get caught up in it.
Yeah.
You get to sing along with the music. The words are up there.
Yeah.
You don't have to mess with a hymnal and a bulletin. And,
oh, yeah.
You're balancing all this stuff. Your
right.
hands are free. So
yeah.
you have a lot of people lifting their hands
yeah.
to pray, yeah. Which is, I think, a great way to pray. But, you know, it is very seductive.
Yeah.
As I look at it. And I think it draws a lot of people that have the hope of kind of moving up in the world. And a lot of what's preached there is eternal reward.
Yeah.
And I came many years ago to a point where I think that true Christianity isn't in it for eternal reward.
Yeah.
It's in it for following Jesus.
Yeah.
It's in it for living a life that is... that glorifies God.
Yeah.
That's not the same as, you know, living a life that's going to give me eternal, immortality
yeah.
and joy.
What would Jesus do? You know, you see that, and he wouldn't do what we're seeing. you know, and you know that, and then you'll get the eye roll if it's, oh, you're being a social justice warrior, right, or something like that. And but you know, in the end, it's kind of, that's really Christianity in many ways distilled, and mm-hmm. and somehow it's lost.
Yes, yeah. I mean, there, the things that you see about Jesus, one is humility.
Yes.
One is a deep love for the people at the margins of society.
Right.
You know, he goes and touches lepers,
yeah,
to heal them, which technically would make him unclean.
Right.
He's touched by a woman that's been on her period for 12 years, which makes him unclean. And he calls attention to that. He's interested even in tax collectors.
Right.
Who have been taken advantage of,
right,
their situation. He's so welcoming to such a diverse group of people.
Right.
And but he's also challenging. I mean, mm-hmm. the challenge is to take up your cross,
right,
and follow him. And that meant something different then.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, take up your electric chair and sit in it.
Right, right.
Would be the closest to a modern interpretation of that.
Yeah.
Can't really imagine many people wanting to do that.
Yeah. Kind of a what if, you know, like if you look at evangelical Christianity, what I would think of is Billy Graham.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he became world known, but he has, you know, in Charlotte, there's the Graham Center, but it wasn't quite that you know, that, like, all these riches that came. How would he see this? Because I know I'm disappointed his son thinks everything's fine.
I'm sure he's turning in his grave, right, as
yeah,
we speak.
Yeah,
and I think that also it points to something, a new kind of problem, and that is sons inheriting their father's churches.
Right.
And so they may not have the, I mean, Billy Graham didn't start off in a mega church.
Yeah.
I mean, he started off pretty humble. And
I have friends in like in Spartanburg, South Carolina, that went to one of his tent revivals.
Yeah.
Just in, I mean, it's like Elmer Gantry, you know, just really, really, you know, just small, and just how moving.
Yeah.
It was, and you know, and yeah, eventually ended up in football stadiums and everything. But that's really kind of where, you know, when I think of Billy Graham, where his real power was.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I've listened to, you know, I had listened to some of his sermons and stuff, and I mean, a lot of what he had to say was, I think, focused on Christ.
Yeah.
And was good to hear. But again, he also came out of a tradition that was focused on getting saved.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how he really felt about this. I know when I was at Notre Dame and then kind of past where I had been and kind of going back into the faith, one summer they were going to host a Billy Graham crusade in the
football at Notre Dame?
At Notre Dame.
Oh, okay.
They were enlisting local churches and volunteers to come and help out, to usher, to, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, you know, collections.
Right.
But one of the things they were recruiting people to do is that when Billy Graham called for people to come and give their lives, they would, you know, the reasoning was, look, people are going to be embarrassed. They're going to feel, you know, alone out there, you know. So if you come down, you know,
break the ice,
it breaks the ice and it draws people in. And but again, what's the message?
Yeah,
you know, it seems to me the message is I'm going to get eternal life.
Yeah,
and I mean, I have no idea what that would even mean, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, how many people have tried to describe heaven?
Yeah.
I think the only person that really got it right was Augustine.
Yeah.
When he said it's the vision of God, it's mm-hmm. seeing God.
Yeah.
And or the beatific vision, I think he called it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just being in God's presence.
Yeah.
What more?
Yeah. What more would you ever want, right?
But you know, you think about it this way. If you and I were to be in God's presence, we'd probably become really aware of a lot of the things that are bad in us.
Yeah.
That we are probably having trouble facing.
Yes.
And so being in the presence of God is both heaven and hell.
Yeah.
In that way.
Yeah, coming to terms with basically all your sins, you know. Yeah. The dramatic change of subject.
Mm-hmm.
The career, the academic career of Dr. Paul Beube. Okay, so how many years teaching, all told?
Well, if you count high school, because I taught high school for 3 years.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I started that in 1976. So you can do the math. It's been a lot of years.
Yeah.
And I didn't like teaching high school. I can tell you that right now. It was an all-boys school.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a good fit for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided, I knew at one point early on that I wanted to go to grad school, but I didn't want to go to grad school immediately out of college. What I didn't know is, did I want to go into philosophy or religion? And when I got to my third year, I started applying to different schools, and I applied to schools that focused on philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
I applied to schools that focused more on religion. I ended up at University of Southern California, and the program they had there was Religious Social Ethics. That was the graduate program.
Mm-hmm.
And that really kind of captured all the things I had interest in.
Right.
So I was still studying philosophy. I was studying psychology and sociology, anthropology, as well as theology. And it was great. I was ready for being in grad school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had perfect grades all the way through. I loved it. I never felt like it was a burden.
Mm-hmm.
I was excited all the way through it. The hardest part was writing the dissertation.
Yeah.
But even that, when I got going, it was really kind of a joy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it on a person that is called a process theologian, John Cobb, who recently died.
Right.
Almost 100 years old.
Yeah.
Had an incredible career. Mm-hmm. Had a real vision of how we understand God, rethinking the way we understand God. Mm-hmm. So often you hear people say, and this is part of the philosophy that crept into Christianity early on,
right?
God never changes. God could do anything, mm-hmm. all powerful, knows everything,
right.
knows future, the past, everything. And process thought, God is not understood that way. So let's start with power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we think of power as somebody that can come in and just make things happen, right?
Right.
Superman kind of power, or what Cobb would call coercive power.
Mm-hmm.
But perfect power isn't coercive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it takes more power for me to convince somebody that I'm right than it does for me to force somebody to do what I want.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes time.
Right.
But it also respects the freedom of the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And it brings us into community.
Right.
And that's God's power. God's power is persuasive power. So God is understood as kind of a lure.
Mm-hmm.
Calling us forward, and God doesn't know everything about the future. The future is novel to God too. Now God made the future possible,
right?
And God knows all the possibilities,
right?
But God doesn't know exactly what choices we're going to make.
Free will.
Free will.
Yeah. The at Southern Cal, was there ever a moment where instead of academia, you thought about the ministry?
I've never thought about ministry. I mean,
why is that?
Let me put it this way. Yeah. Being a good Catholic boy, I was recruited to go to what they call minor seminary, which is a high school seminary.
Mm-hmm.
And I got kind of creeped out, to be honest, by the way I was being recruited. I suspect that that was probably not a good step for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So I knew I wanted to go to just college. I also knew that I didn't want to live a life of celibacy.
Yeah.
That was just not something that I felt was me.
Joni's happy.
I hope so. And my two daughters are probably
very happy too. Yeah.
I knew early on that I did not want to become a minister. Even when I became Protestant, I could go into ministry. Right. It's not my thing.
Yeah.
It's not my gift. Mm-hmm. I'm not. You could probably tell from this podcast. I'm not a great speaker.
Yeah.
I have done sermons. Let's
the jury's out. Cheyenne, great speaker.
Thank you, Cheyenne. That was nice.
No, I think you're underselling yourself. But so at Southern Cal, you get a master's.
No, I thought I was going to get a master's.
Oh, okay.
In Southern Cal, they told me that my advisor said, "Why are you in the master's program? Why'd you put down master's?" And I said, "Well, don't you have to have a master's before you get a PhD?"
Yeah.
He says, "Not here."
Whoa.
And he says, "You go straight into the PhD program. You're just wasting your time doing a thesis and then later doing a dissertation."
Yeah.
And so I skipped it. Now, I could have, if I got to the point where it wasn't working out for me, mm-hmm. After I passed my qualifying exams, I could have said, "I'm stopping."
Yeah.
And they would have basically given me a master's degree at that point. So I had to study the things that first and to get a master's degree, but I never did a master's. Wow. I just went straight on to the PhD.
And then with your doctorate, you went then to teach high school?
No, I taught high school for 3 years before I went to grad school.
Ah, got it. And then so now you're moving into a college or university.
Right. I mean, I was doing adjunct teaching for a couple places while I was finishing my dissertation, mm-hmm. and shortly after I finished my dissertation, my first job offer was at a college in Kansas, Kansas Wesleyan University, mm-hmm. Which was a good experience. I learned a lot there, and I liked the fact that it was a Methodist institution because I was very involved in the Methodist Church. But there were a lot of limitations.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to do a little bit more in the line of research and writing,
mm-hmm.
and there was no time.
Yeah.
The amount of work that I had to do was just really ridiculous. So I have a lot of respect, and the pay was awful.
Yeah.
I have a series of jobs of bad pay,
Right.
You know, I saw an advertisement after almost 14 years at Kansas Wesleyan. I saw this advertisement for a job here, and it described everything I was doing.
Right.
They wanted a generalist. I was mm-hmm. teaching Bible. I was teaching world religions. I was teaching philosophy of religion. I was teaching mm-hmm. ethics. And that's what they were looking for, somebody that could do that.
Right.
And I came out here in a November day that it was like 70 degrees, and I thought, I just had left Kansas with 32 degrees, and I'm thinking that, you know, Kansas is not where I want to be. So they offered me the position. It had to be a family decision.
Mm-hmm.
So my youngest daughter was going into third grade, I think, and my oldest daughter was going into ninth grade.
Oh, that's tough. Yeah,
And if they had said, "We don't want to leave," we wouldn't have.
Yeah.
But they were both, they were both interested in mm-hmm. making a change.
Yeah.
Finding something new, and Joni also was willing to do that, and I was obviously excited about doing it, and it's been a huge blessing being here. Yeah. My kids found things in their lives that we would have not seen in Kansas.
Like what?
Well, my oldest daughter went her last 2 years of high school at the ASMSU, or whatever it's called now, the Arkansas Science and Arts, and I can't even remember now. ASMSA, I can't. I think that's right. So that was down in Hot Springs.
Oh, and a couple hours away, then
I got tired of that commute. But it was, you know, she had a good experience. She ended up, you know, she got a lot of science out there, and she actually went to college. She got accepted at USC.
Yeah.
You know, Joni and I were kind of hoping she'd be a Trojan, but instead she decided to be a hog, and so she went to Arkansas.
Stay in state, yeah.
But they gave her, I mean, she actually left Arkansas with more money than she brought in.
Yeah.
The scholarships were very generous. She had a good experience there. She met somebody and decided that she was going to go to North Carolina to be with him. And she got a job at a place called NMAR, and it's a, well, eventually a software engineer. That's what she does now.
Yeah.
And she loves it, and she's very good at it. And married now, not to that guy, but to somebody else, and who's a really, really great guy. My youngest daughter was very musical. I mean, my oldest daughter was too, but she didn't like performing. But my youngest daughter liked being on the stage. And she started, she had taken a year of cello at Kansas, and they came here. They didn't have a strings program at that time. And so we needed to get her into the band.
Right.
So she gets into the band. She was late getting into the band. And we were hoping she was going to get flute because Joni's sister had a flute and wouldn't have to worry about the instrument. And they said, well, there's only one instrument left, and that's the oboe. And she was able to get a sound, a beautiful sound out of it, like right away. I mean, I was like, you know, people usually squeak. And she just, it just was a natural for her. She went to Allstate two times while she was a student here. She went away to college and actually was first chair in the orchestra at Oklahoma City University. But her real major was theater, musical theater. And she did great with it. She is an actress, singer, dancer now. And now the mother of my grandson. And so, you know, I think it all worked out really well.
One theater parent to another, you gotta love it. Kind of looking back, just teaching. Kind of, I won't get into the kids these days, you know, because Cheyenne may feel triggered if we go into that too much. Sorry, Cheyenne, but you know, just thinking about it, what kept you teaching? You know, kind of what was it that really that. There's good days, bad days, but there's then something that just captured why, you know, I'm here, and I and you had a career dedicated to teaching.
I think two things. One is the model here was the teacher scholar. And the scholarship was meant to support your teaching, your scholarship. And so I had time to do more writing since I had a much smaller load than I had at the previous institution. So the ability to write was really, really nice. The classroom was also really nice in different ways. And I really liked, it was funny, I did not do much in graduate work with Bible. Because I was doing social ethics and I was studying different things. But I did take a couple of courses. And when I was adjuncting at the Long Beach State University, they needed, somebody was going on sabbatical and they needed somebody to teach introduction to the Bible. And I looked at the textbook and I talked to the guy who was teaching it. He says, you can do that.
Yeah.
And so I did. And I thought, wow. So when I went to Kansas Wesleyan, I taught, you know, I was the religion department, mm-hmm. and so I taught everything, and I taught Old Testament, New Testament, prophets, letters of Paul. I mean, just a lot mm-hmm. of stuff, and in which was really an opportunity to study and get into that in much more depth than I could have ever done.
Right.
And I found that teaching Bible to students is one of the joys I've had.
Yeah.
I mean, I love teaching ethics because that's my thing.
Right.
But I get a chance to help people to see the world in a different way, to see yeah. the Bible in a new way, yeah. and to show them that, you know, critical study of the Bible is not something that can hurt your faith. It's something that can actually deepen and broaden your faith. I mean, there's been kids that were unhappy. Yeah. Usually yeah. they drop out
sure.
before, you know, withdrawal. But yeah. But most of the students, I think, got something from it.
Yeah.
And I loved it. You know, I still do. I love introducing people to things mm-hmm. that they, you know, I do. In my New Testament class, the first thing I do is give a quiz on right. Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's right after Christmas.
Right.
And I ask all these, I do ask like 12 or so questions. And they usually don't do very well.
Yeah.
And they think they know, you know, the Christmas story real well. They do. They know the Christmas story at their church
right.
real well or on the movies, but they don't really know what's in the scripture itself. And so it becomes kind of an eye-opening experience.
Yeah.
And I like when people get it.
Yeah.
I've got some students right now who really get it, and that's really nice. Exciting.
Kind of last question.
Yeah.
Kind of any advice that you would give to kind of, young people that would want to major in religion, ethics, philosophy, what advice would you give them now that you're kind of at the, you know, kind of in this chapter of your life?
I'd probably give the advice that I got when I was trying to decide my major.
Yeah.
And I used to, you know, here we used to have the professors did the freshman advising.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got students, you know, had all kinds of interests and stuff. But I took my first semester sophomore year, I took two business classes. I took mm-hmm. econ and I took management. Those are the only two that were still open.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in these huge classes.
Yeah.
But I thought I need to have something that I can, you know, my parents aren't going to feel like they wasted their money on me. And what I discovered is I don't like the kind of things you have to do in management.
Yeah.
I didn't like that approach.
Mm-hmm.
Econ was interesting. I mean, just kind of cerebrally interesting, but it didn't get me excited. So I was talking with some friends, what should I do? I liked English a lot.
Yeah.
I liked religion and philosophy a lot. So this grad student happened to wander into our conversation
mm-hmm.
and he said, you know, you can always get an MBA after you graduate. It doesn't matter what you major in. You can go in that direction.
Right.
But you might die the day after you graduate. So what would you take? When were you going to study if you knew you were going to die the day after you graduate?
I'd take an MBA. Wrong answer.
Yeah. I mean, I knew theology. I knew it was theology. Because that was a class that was really that pushed me the most, that really connected to me on a personal level as well as an intellectual level.
Right.
So that's what I tell my students. I say, you know, choose a major that, you know, really gives you joy, and that if you died the day after you graduate, you wouldn't regret. You know, some students are thinking they want to go into ministry, and I say, you don't have to study theology mm-hmm. or Bible to go into ministry. In fact, some seminaries don't want you to.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're wrong for that, but I understand why they say that. And some will go ahead and major in religion anyway. you know, if they want to major in religion, I mean, I just, you know, I want to see if they really are excited about it. And, but, you know, a lot of students come out here out of religion and they go into different fields.
Yeah.
I've been asked several times to write recommendations for kids going to law school, law school. That's probably the best one of the major ones that.
Yeah, but graduate school, and then there's obviously all the pre-health, you know, with pre-med, which, you know, they.
There's been students that not majored, but minored in religion. Yeah. I think that became doctors out of here. It's often a major or a minor that is picked up after they've got the one they want to pursue professionally.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
They don't have to make a job out of it. The funny thing is, I've always had a job in religion.
Yeah,
but I think that I'm kind of unusual that way.
Kind of after the semester ends, kind of any plans, any kind of things that you have in mind that you want to catch up on?
Well, I mean, the big thing is getting to see my grandson more often.
Yeah, in Connecticut.
New Jersey.
Cool. I was in the region.
All you're in the right part of the country. But, you know, I was asked, what do you want to do? What do you want to have a party when you retire? What do you want to do?
Yeah.
And I'm not really a party person. I said, you know, I'd like to do something with the whole family.
Yeah.
You know, maybe go on a cruise to Alaska. So we're going on a cruise to Alaska.
Alaska. There you go. All right.
I should have said, go to Disney World, because that's what you normally say, you know. But no.
Well, we could get a rager going on in Greek Row, you know, for you. Just a thought. Yeah. Well, either way, Paul, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is, we were talking about this for a while, and I'm great conversation. I always love talking with you.
Yeah, same here.
All right, and I always love talking with our audience, and of course, and Cheyenne's smiling because she knows I'm going to get to her in a moment. But no, I'm going to get to Cheyenne right now. So thank you for listening to the Career Pathways podcast. We have new episodes every Monday, so please be on the watch. And we'd love to have you obviously watch or listen to us. Love to have you subscribe. And even better, if you could write a review. And how many stars should they give that review, Cheyenne?
5.
Yep, that's it. Thank you very much. So, yeah, if you can do that, that would be great. But, where can you find the Career Pathways podcast? Someone has the answer.
You can find the Career Pathways podcast on 99.97% of all platforms, the same amount of germs that get killed with Germix, supposedly.
Yeah, I have it. Yeah, that's pretty definitive. But yeah. Either way, Paul, thank you again.
Sure.
It was wonderful. And thank you, our audience, and we just hope you keep with us on the Career Pathways podcast. Take care.
This broadcast is sponsored in part by Lyon College and by Kilt Studios.